Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck. The Department of Environmental Quality has released a plan for tackling the ozone problem in Sublette County. Emissions from the energy industry there have combined to form a type of pollution called ozone, which can be a health hazard. Ozone levels have been so high that they violate federal standards, and the Environmental Protection Agency has given Wyoming 3 years to fix the problem.
Last year, a task force of citizens, industry reps, and local leaders recommended solutions. Among other things, they called for tougher regulations on industry and more research into the science behind ozone formation. Earlier this year, the DEQ met with the task force to respond to the recommendations. But many felt the plans they laid out at the meeting were not concrete enough. Since then, DEQ has been working to draft a more specific strategy. This week, they released that strategy. I spoke with DEQ's Air Quality Administrator Steve Dietrich to get the details. He says they'll continue to encourage energy companies to take voluntary measures to limit the types of emissions that cause ozone, but they also hope to impose a number of new rules. First, they'd like stricter limits on emissions from new production equipment.
Rather than have control requirements happen after startup of the facility or the area where the well drilling and well production happens, it would have to be in place upon startup of those facilities. It would have to be cleaner sooner.
Dietrich says they also want to take steps to reduce emissions from older equipment. That's equipment that's operating perfectly legally, but is polluting more than newer equipment because it was installed prior to the current emissions rules. Dietrich says they're starting a process that will let them look at options for retrofitting or replacing those older facilities.
It allows us to re-examine permits, if you will, permanent facilities, to revisit what control measures can be put in place to reduce emissions further from those existing operating facilities.
Wyoming has different standards for the energy industry depending on where the drilling is happening. For example, in the Jonah Field, which is part of the area that's experiencing ozone spikes, there are stricter emissions requirements than elsewhere in the state.
What we're trying to do is to expand those requirements to all of the non-attainment area.
As in, all of the area where ozone levels violate federal standards. Dietrich says the new rules they're creating may seem strict, but that's because they're taking into consideration future development in the area.
You want to allow new growth, but you need to be cognizant of what those new emissions would be. And so it may be that you want to reduce emissions further to allow for that new growth and thereby still be able to attain the standard in the future.
Dietrich says as they move forward with new rules and initiatives, they'll revise their ozone strategy.
This plan is just a start. It's an evolving document. It evolves because the results we see with some of our earlier efforts may have a direct impact on what we need to do in the future, but also we may get other requirements that EPA hasn't come out with yet, so we have to be flexible enough with this plan that it can evolve with those new requirements.
DEQ plans to begin the rulemaking processes within the next 6 months. In the meantime, the agency is designating an ozone point person who will be in charge of answering questions and taking input from the public about the ozone problem. That person will be announced next week.
You can read the full text of DEQ's ozone strategy, which includes information on measures the agency is already taking, on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org. The effects of automatic spending cuts or sequestration are being felt in the Cowboy State. Because of the automatic spending cuts, Yellowstone has been forced to trim $1.75 million from its operating budget. It's caused Yellowstone Superintendent Dan Wenk to delay plowing operations within the park, a move that has upset some gateway communities and caused others to find a solution. Cody officials have been working hard to find a way to open the East Gate on time, despite the federal government. From Cody, David Cook has more.
Leaders in the Yellowstone Gateway community of Cody are plowing ahead with a plan to open on May 3rd. The Cody Chamber of Commerce called an emergency meeting on Wednesday to discuss the proposition of plowing roads along the park's east entrance after Governor Meade said he will provide equipment and labor from the Wyoming Department of Transportation to clear the snow.
What I've told those communities, if they have a way to come up with the money and they can pay for the manpower and equipment, that we'll provide the manpower and the equipment, but I just don't feel comfortable using state dollars to do that. So we're looking at Jackson and Cody and see if they come up with the money, and if they do, from private donations or otherwise, we'll try to help out that way.
There appears to be a lot of support for finding a way to plow the east entrance in Yellowstone. Yellowstone Superintendent Dan Wink has said if Cody can pull off such an effort and be part of a solution, then the park is willing to meet those efforts halfway.
If Cody can do that and is willing to do that, I think that's a great opportunity for the community of Cody and actually for Wyoming. I sat down and talked to a number of the elected officials of the area and business leaders. We talked about this possibility. I certainly am open to it. I've said that we would certainly allow this to happen. If we can do that, if we can meet somewhere in the middle and open it sooner, I have absolutely committed that we would maintain the road, we would keep it open, and we would be willing to open it as soon as those snow plows could meet in the middle.
Cody Chamber of Commerce Executive Director Scott Ballio has been instrumental in leading the efforts with area representatives to work out a solution.
Representatives have been working with the governor's office and with the Park Service to try to determine if there is a solution to getting the East Road plowed so that we can open on May 3rd.
After calling an emergency meeting of the Cody Chamber, their membership has decided there is a solution. They've decided on an ambitious plan to raise the money so that plowing can begin on time.
Essentially, what we need to do by April 1st is raise $100,000 so that YDOT can plow up the East Road in order to be open on May 3rd, which is our traditional opening date. If we're able to do that, we'll avoid the two-week delay that's in place currently because of sequestration. So that's why we're attempting to raise the money.
It's estimated that the East Gate would have lost 10,000 cars entering into the park because of a two-week delay, and the local economies would lose close to $2 million in revenue. Beyond that, there would be a ripple effect felt throughout the state.
We looked at the numbers from previous years in terms of traffic volume through the East Gate during the first 2 weeks, and we determined that there's an up to a $2 million economic impact in the local economy. And beyond that, there's a ripple effect that occurs too. If people cancel their plans early in the season, they may not reschedule. So we looked at the potential business that was going to be lost, kind of the lack of confidence that it would instill in people if they didn't think they could get into the park, and we just felt that this was something we needed to step up and do on behalf of our members and on behalf of the Cody community.
The Cody Chamber has taken their first step in fundraising the needed $100,000 for plowing operations by announcing an Open the Gate Fund that people can donate to and pledging to match outside donations by up to $50,000. Within hours of announcing the plan to plow the east entrance to Yellowstone, the Cody Chamber reported over $20,000 in donations. For more on the planned and fundraising efforts, you can go online to codychamber.org. For Wyoming Public Radio in Cody, I'm David Cook.
When we come back, we'll talk about a plan to convince some farmers to give up their water rights. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck. A small corner of southeast Wyoming sits over the Ogallala Aquifer. The Ogallala is a huge aquifer that stretches from Wyoming and Nebraska all the way to Texas. It's a key source of water for agriculture, but it's being depleted faster than it can recharge. So, the Natural Resources Conservation Service is trying to help save it. Here in Wyoming, they're doing that by encouraging farmers to give up their water rights. Wyoming Public Radio's Willow Belden has the story.
It's not clear how long it will take before the water in the Ogallala runs out. There's a lot that scientists don't understand about how aquifers work, and unpredictable factors like weather come into play. But it is clear that the current rate of water consumption is unsustainable. State engineer Pat Terrell says Laramie County monitoring wells indicate that water levels have dropped a foot or two per year over the past few decades, and he says that's worrisome.
Tens of feet in an aquifer that may be 100, 200 feet in total thickness is important, so we are concerned about that aquifer.
In parts of Texas, the aquifer has already been depleted so much that irrigated agriculture is impossible. The Natural Resources Conservation Service is trying to keep that from happening elsewhere. Jim Pike is in charge of the effort in Wyoming. He's targeting farmers because they typically use a lot of water for irrigation.
I'm offering a payment for them to give up, basically give up their water allocation, for the greater good.
In other words, Pike is trying to convince farmers to give up their water rights forever. In exchange, he offers a financial incentive. Mike Polma is one farmer who agreed to Pike's proposal. Polma's farm sits on a flat, open plain near Carpenter. 3 years ago, he abandoned his wells and switched to dryland farming. That means he now relies solely on rainwater. As we drive around the property, Polma points out the shriveled brown remnants of a failed crop.
This is what was dried up and became dry land. And that was millet, and you can see how it just didn't grow and it burned up.
Polma says without water, he can't grow as much. In fact, last year, he didn't harvest anything. But then again, his harvests had not been good for a while. That's because in recent years, his wells had been drying up.
I didn't have any water, period, you know, or not much, so it was borderline whether it was worth turning on the wells.
Because his wells were in such bad shape, Polma says it made sense to sign on to the NRCS program and give up his water rights. The NRCS has been paying him $35,000 a year, which helped make up for the lost crops and got him out of debt. The payments end after 3 years, but he says he's not worried about the future.
I'm 60 years old and all my debts are paid off, so I don't have to make nearly as much as I used to.
But in many cases, getting farmers to abandon their wells has been a tough sell. Irrigated land can produce at least twice as much, and in some cases 10 times as much as dry land. So if you switch to dry land, you have far fewer crops to sell. That's why hay producer Todd Fornstrom decided not to participate in the NRCS program.
I guess what I would say is it would be a way to get out of farming in kind of a step-by-step process, and we're kind of in the expansion mode or maintenance mode rather than trying to get out of farming.
Plus, property values drop if the land has no water rights. Still, experts say abandoning wells doesn't involve as big a financial hit as you might think. Danelle Peck is an ag economist at the University of Wyoming. She says, sure, switching to dry land reduces productivity, but your electricity costs also go way down because you don't have to pump water.
So there's a little bit of a trade-off. Lower yields, but also lower costs.
So far, the NRCS has convinced producers in Laramie County to stop irrigating 2,000 acres of farmland, which is saving 1 billion gallons of water a year.
2,000 acres, not large scale, quite honestly.
That's David Brower with the USDA's Agricultural Research Service in Texas. He says based on their experiences, meaningful water conservation only happens under two circumstances.
One, there's large scale buy-in. Second, there's some sort of regulation and policy put in place, either by a water district or whatever, that limits the amount that's pumped.
But Jim Pike says they have to start somewhere.
It's a step in the right direction. But we need to do more. We haven't solved the problem here by any means.
Pike says if they can double the amount of acreage that's taken out of irrigation in Laramie County, it could start to make a noticeable difference. Brower says it's still probably just buying time. Still, he says buying time is worthwhile. He says if the aquifer is depleted more slowly, it will give scientists and the ag community time to come up with ways to deal with the dwindling water supply, whether that means pumping water from the East Coast, or modifying crops to need less water, or just learning how to farm on dry land more efficiently. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Willow Belden.
Social workers play a big role in Wyoming, and the month of March honors their work. Kimberly Harper is the executive director of the National Association of Social Workers. She says, like a lot of organizations, they're dealing with budget cuts.
Certainly, we've faced a reduction of resources. We've had to get creative, but social workers are always great problem solvers, always great at trying to pull people together and find creative solutions to things. So in some ways, it's just caused us to be a little bit more creative in how we do things.
We certainly don't see the economy that a lot of states do, although some of theirs are bouncing back. You get the impression, though, when you see millions and billions of dollars in the state legislature, that that's probably the way it is for everybody. Are there still some real economic issues out there that you guys are helping people kind of fight through?
Absolutely, yeah. We see economic issues for folks, and we see limited resources. You know, there are a lot of resources this legislative session. There was a focus certainly on education and issues like that, but there are still needs for mental health services. There are still needs for people that don't have access to health care, that have to travel because of our rural and frontier nature. And so those are all challenges that we try and meet within the state, even though we are not looking at cutting as many things as other states do.
Would you talk a little bit about the economics? You've mentioned it twice. Obviously, that's a big one with you. What's impacted you, and what are you looking at?
Some of the challenges for Wyoming are the distance, the fact that there are limited resources in some of our towns, and so there may not be access to travel for mental health services, for support services, for some of the things that we think about in larger cities where you can just find a group that meets your needs for something or connect with other people that have similar issues or concerns. That may be a struggle here in Wyoming. And so that ability to reach out to resources can be impacted by the resources that people have.
What sort of children's issues are on your top of your agenda these days?
You know, we're always attentive to parenting issues, child abuse and neglect issues, access to education, access to special needs services and resources, mental health services for children and youth. Obviously, Wyoming has a high suicide rate, and that's something that we're attentive to in making sure that that education's there, that support's there, that people know what kinds of resources they have for dealing with those stressors.
Mm-hmm. The mental health issue has always been a big one in this state for many, many years. Are we making headway there, or is that, again, going to be something because of limited resources that we're going to be battling with maybe for a few more years here?
You know, I think it's always going to be a battle. Unfortunately, there continues to be a stigma around mental health issues, and so we see that even nationwide, a lot of these issues that are coming up around some of the tragic events that have happened have had a component of mental health, and that there are still people that aren't as willing to step forward and say that they need to address some mental health issues. The flip side of that is the limitation on resources as well. You know, there aren't a lot of funding sources for mental health issues. There aren't a lot of practitioners out there for mental health, but we do the best we can to try and make sure that those things are there.
I hear people tell me on the mental health side that they're always looking at, you know, creative ways to get more mental health services out there. Is that working, by the way?
Is it working? Tough question. I'm not really sure. But I think we certainly continue to try to be creative and to try and address those stigmas and those barriers that keep people from that. You see that there are more people willing to acknowledge that they have some kind of a mental illness or a diagnosis, more talk and more education about depression and stress and how you manage that. And so in some ways, I think we are making progress, but I still think we have a long way to go.
Since I'm I guess, officially elderly myself. Maybe I have a conflict of interest here, but elderly issues is something we haven't talked about. What's kind of the key issues out there right now for you guys in that area?
You know, I have some personal interest in that way. Part of what I do in addition to my job with NASW is some work for hospice. And so for me, attention to that issue of end-of-life planning, advanced decision-making, having some choices about who's going to make decisions for you, being more informed about what your health care options are is a big one for me. We're seeing some changes along the lines of housing opportunities and living opportunities for people that are aging, more of the ideas of kind of green communities or intergenerational support systems. And I think that'll be an interesting thing to watch over the next few years.
It's National Social Work Month here in the month of March. Kimberly Harper, a pleasure. Thank you for stopping by and telling us about it.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll explore the topic of gambling addictions and look at the issue of domestic violence. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Willow Belden. This week, the governor signed into law a bill that would allow the state to participate in a lottery. Opponents fear that some may become addicted to trying to win easy money and that poor people might suffer the most. Gambling addiction issues have been dismissed by many, but in Fremont County, where gaming on the Wind River Indian Reservation is allowed, many believe there are problems associated with gambling. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhorov looked into this issue and filed this report.
The Wind River Hotel and Casino in Riverton is full of chirping slot machines, game tables, bright lights, and gamblers. There are different opinions regarding how much good gaming has brought to the county and tribes, but there is also concern about gambling addictions.
In 2006 is when I probably started gambling compulsively.
That's a compulsive gambler in recovery we'll call Anna, who did not want her real name used.
Started out just like everyone else, going out with $20. Went out with my friend, we would have dinner, play a little bit, laugh and joke, and it was all fun. It continued to be fun for a while. And then the amount of money we put in went up, and then it just got out of hand.
Anna declined to share the details of her story, except to say that it got real bad. We met at a Gamblers Anonymous meeting in a church located just a couple minutes' drive from the big casino. Only two of the five regulars attended that particular meeting, one of whom was the organizer, who also didn't want her name used. She started the meetings when a friend sought help and found no resources in the community. She got in touch with the International Gamblers Anonymous office, found the space for the meetings, and bought materials out of pocket.
Gambling isn't spoke of. Nobody talks about it. You know, even with all the casinos we have in Fremont County, nobody talks about gambling and people losing their houses, losing everything they own. It happens all the time.
The organizer and Anna are both clear that it's not the casino's fault, but they say that gambling addiction is still very much a problem. There are no statistics about whether the number of gambling addicts is increasing. Here's Fremont County prosecuting attorney Brian Varn.
I don't know that I can say that it's been an increase for certain. I know that in the last 4 years we've had around 8 cases in which the defendants themselves told us that the reason they had been involved in embezzlement and theft from their employers was because of their gambling.
He suspects other cases were also linked to gambling, but he can't be sure. Varn says those numbers aren't exactly an epidemic, and the Gamblers Anonymous meetings aren't overflowing either. But the National Council of Problem Gambling estimates that there are 8,000 problem gamblers and 4,000 pathological gamblers in Wyoming. Executive Director of the Council, Keith White, says nobody actually counts, so the numbers could be higher. In the past 6 months, the council's hotline received an average of 50 calls a month from Wyoming. White says part of the problem is that gambling is legal, and gambling addiction isn't often seen as an illness.
Until recently, it hasn't been seen as also a public health problem. The state has been very slow to address it and respond to it, just like other diseases like diabetes or drug abuse or depression, although we see them and the medical community sees them as all very similarly related.
The Fremont County Counseling Service is one entity that is taking the issue seriously, despite the lack of data. They're starting a gambling awareness group that will teach classes about signs and symptoms of gambling addiction, what to look out for, and how to engage someone who may be a problem gambler. So far, demand for the class has been low. For now, though, Director of Fremont Counseling Service, Jerry McAdams, says the class is still worth holding.
Need and demand are two different things. I'm not opposed to doing things that when I know there's a need, but then at some point in time, we have to catch up the need and the demand together where we can run a viable program.
The Wind River Casino recognizes there is a problem, too. The casino's Andrea Clifford says they've seen it affect their employees. The casino has brought in specialists to train all staff on problem gambling awareness and train local counselors to specialize in gambling addiction. They also provide self-exclusion, where people self-identify themselves and are asked to leave the casino if found there. But the organizer and Anna both said it doesn't work. Finally, the casino used to help out with GA meetings in the past. Currently, however, Clifford says casino staff is stretched thin, and it doesn't help that there aren't other resources in the area.
It was kind of hard for us because when we called the National Hotline for Problem Gambling, they didn't even realize that Wyoming had casinos here. So, we were kind of like, yeah, we're here, we've been here, and we need some services and some help.
Current GA meetings convene at the Church of Christ in Riverton every Monday at 6 p.m. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Irina Zhorov.
When we talk about domestic violence, we usually focus on the perpetrators and the victims, but children in abusive families are also deeply affected. We're joined now by Haley Rhea. She's a sophomore at UW, and her father killed her mother.
It happened in the night, and the day before I had school and a basketball game, and then me and my mom went to the store and got dinner and went home. My dad always works, so he was at work, and I went to bed that night in my room, and I woke up in the middle of the night, and my dad had laundry in his arms, and it was really late, and I asked him what he was doing, and he said, nothing, go back to bed. So he laid it with me, and I fell back asleep, and then when I woke up in the morning, my mom was gone, and he said she had run off with a boyfriend, and so he took me to school and told me not to tell anyone she was missing, and
who eventually broke the news to you?
Throughout that day, my grandparents were calling her. They talked on the phone every day, and so they called me to see where she was, and I didn't know. And so they called a coworker, and he called the police, and they came and talked to me, and I went to a foster home. And then the next day, I got told that they had suspicion that my mom had been killed by my dad. It took a few days after that to find her. They had searchers everywhere, and they had a helicopter, and they eventually found her out in the wilderness.
Why did he kill her?
They were getting a divorce.
And that's it?
Yeah.
Now, I know he had not been physically abusive up until then. was there verbal abuse going on? Were there warning signs here that in retrospect, maybe you or your mom or one of her friends might have picked up on?
Well, like, he was controlling. Like, we would go to visit my family in Wyoming, and he would have to work, and then he'd just show up there, and he'd have to sit right next to her all the time. Couldn't leave. She could never just, like, go off with her sisters. He had to be there all the time. Like, when we went out to eat, we could only order off the dollar menu and stuff like that. The days before, he would not eat. He would not sleep. He just sat there, and his voice changed, and it was really weird.
And, of course, then your father was convicted and sent to prison, and then you went to live with your grandparents in Lander.
Yeah.
I can imagine that must have been very difficult growing up without your parents. What would you tell friends if, you know, if they would ask, why aren't you living with your mom and your dad?
I would either tell them it was a long story or that my dad killed my mom. And most of the people in Lander were notified before I came there. And so they had already known, so they wouldn't question me.
Have you spoken to your dad since then?
No.
I can imagine that something like this would leave pretty big emotional scars. What do you do to cope with it?
I used to run a website. Now I run a Facebook page in memory of her. Basically just speaking to all the schools.
And you've gone around the country doing this?
Yeah.
What's the sort of message that you would like to get across to people with your Facebook page, with talking to people? What advice do you have? What warning signs should people look for?
There's so many warning signs. Like, if they're controlling, they're constantly texting you, where are you, what are you doing, just putting you down, saying, I'm going to kill myself if you leave me. There's so many things, just emotional abuse, physical abuse, financial abuse.
And when you say emotional or financial abuse, what does that mean?
Like, withholding money, giving you an allowance, making you beg for money, or emotional, always putting you down, always making you feel like you have to be with them to feel good.
Obviously, these are warning signs that we can imagine that a potential victim would want to look out for. What about children? What about people like you? I mean, are there things that younger kids should know that when they're looking at their parents' relationships?
Like, if they're constantly fighting, constantly putting each other down, not ever happy, not sleeping with each other or anything, there could be a problem. Mostly, kids are abused if there is a domestic violence situation. They're abused also.
Haley Rhea, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Figuring out cost-effective ways to upgrade rural health care is the goal of all hospitals and medical providers in the state, but it is especially tough for the smallest rural facilities.
The number of doctors are small, which can lead to mistakes, and specialists are at a premium. But thanks to electronic records and other forms of telemedicine, things are starting to improve.
This is Platte County Memorial Hospital in Wheatland. The hospital is owned by Banner Health, one of the leaders in the effort to get electronic medicine into rural areas. Inside a nearby room sits the hospital's informatics coordinator, Deborah Lockman. Lockman types in information that could be part of a massive electronics record system that has changed the way they do business. If you are a lot like a lot of us in Wyoming, you get used to repeating your medical histories over and over. And because of that, mistakes are made. Under their system, those records are stored on a computer and can be accessed by other providers if needed.
It helps when the patients come in, their histories carry over, their allergies carry over. However, at the same time, we confirm that information.
Medical errors have been a part of healthcare for many years. But under this system, Lockman says errors are reduced. For one thing, nurses and others have a better idea of what a doctor wants.
The physicians enter their orders. There's that eliminates that need to interpret that handwriting. There are several safety features that come from that. There are alerts that alert the physician while they're writing their orders.
In other words, if a physician starts to make a diagnosis, the computer alerts the doctor to check some specific things and even asks the doctor to double-check things. Then, if they prescribe the wrong medication, they'll also get an alert. Pharmacist David Burke says they have a similar system that helps them make sure that a prescription fits the patient's needs, and it also checks to see they're getting the right amount.
It's eliminated a lot of errors or potential errors. There's no deciding whether that's an L or that's a 50 or that's a 500. There's checks and balances that you didn't used to be. The human side or the human error potential is really diminished.
Medical providers are equally thrilled at the Washakie Medical Center in Worland, where they have an advanced system that the hospitals in Wheatland and Torrington will soon be getting. Nan Sutherland oversees some of the electronic medicine efforts in Worland. She says they can use the technology to cross-check to make sure they're treating patients properly.
We can pull information out and monitor and track the quality and level of care that our patients are receiving and be certain that the care that we are providing is timely and is lining up with evidence-based best practices.
This technology also can keep patients from having to be transferred to a larger hospital's intensive care unit. Banner's Deb Dahl says they have devised a system where specialists can observe patients in intensive care and then through technology monitor them.
There are a group of physicians, critical care docs, sitting in Mesa, Arizona, and they are monitoring patients in Worland, Wyoming at the Washakie facility there. The technology that's linked to the electronic medical record looks for adverse trends and allows the clinicians to intervene before those adverse trends become adverse outcomes.
Dahl says by using two-way communication and technology, they're starting to use this with psychologists, neurologists, and other specialists.
Physician can be talking with the patient, can be talking with the patient's provider or as a team, and work through that assessment, prescribe medication, do all the things that you could do in person, but just do it through the telemedicine tool.
Washakie Medical Center's Chief of Nursing Cheryl Sorensen says this will lead to a savings for everyone.
We are able to care for patients here in their own community where they're nearer their support systems. And then that, of course, decreases cost to the payer that's paying for that patient's hospital care, the cost that the family incur to travel.
Dahl says this could be a game changer for smaller hospitals that are trying to survive but do not have the ability to afford a specialist, and for patients who may be able to get care locally. But Dahl also touts the improved care that telemedicine can provide. She says it is saving and will save lives in the future. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
When we come back, we'll have an interview with best-selling author C.J. Box. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck. The 13th Joe Pickett novel by Wyoming author C.J. Box has hit the stores. Box is both a best-selling and award-winning author for his Joe Pickett series, which surrounds the trials and tribulations of a Wyoming game warden, and for three additional novels. Box says he writes about a book and a half a year. He joins us to discuss the latest novel, Breaking Point, but also reflects on his career. Box tells us that it took a while before he had success as a writer.
The first book I got published was in 2001, and I was 40 years old. So, no, I didn't start straight out of college. worked on it for a long time. But since then, I've sort of felt unleashed because the first book did well and every subsequent book has done better than the last. And I've got publishers now who, at least with the series, want a book a year. And then the standalones I kind of do when I can.
Tell people a little bit about your background. I mean, had you been writing all along?
I had been. I'd been working on manuscripts and fiction writing ever since I graduated from I went to the University of Denver. My first job was at the Saratoga Sun newspaper. And at that point, I started working on stories and potential manuscripts. But it still took literally another 20 years before I not only had something good enough to publish, but it took a long time once the publisher decided to publish to put it out.
Now, the Saratoga Sun was probably important for you because that's sort of where you met Joe Pickett.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And a lot of – I draw an awful lot of the scenery and the people and the characters and even some of the issues from those years covering them on the newspaper.
The character we're referring to is obviously somebody who is a game warden. And what got you to the point where you say, I could write about him?
Well, you know, it didn't start with the character, strangely enough. It started with the issue in the first book, Open Season, is that I wanted to kind of retell that old saga with the black-footed ferrets, if you recall those. Mm-hmm. I remember growing up in Wyoming, seeing the wanted posters and you know, there was the thought that they were extinct. And then once they were found around Meteetse, I was fascinated with that story, especially to find out how many people in that area knew that they'd been there all along and didn't want to tell anybody. And I thought, what an interesting kind of take on things. And in order to write that story, I had several different protagonists that I was working on, first a sheriff, then a newspaper reporter, and finally settled on a game warden because Wyoming game wardens are so unique. And I was doing ride-alongs with a game warden in Saratoga at the time. So I thought this would be the right kind of guy to carry this story.
When you wrote, were you thinking I'm going to be writing for a regional audience? It'll probably be my friends, neighbors, people in the state that'll be interested in this?
Yes. I always kind of thought that if I could get a book published that it would be fairly well received in the state and in the, you know, Rocky Mountain region, because I considered the issues in it kind of parochial in a way. And it surprised me when the first one came out how much attention it got nationally. It was a New York Times notable mm-hmm. book and was nominated for a bunch of awards. And I realized a lot of the issues that I'd always considered very local are national and international as well, because so many things we talk about in Wyoming are kind of on the cutting edge of so many big things: environmentalism, you know, the culture, wilderness, energy development. All those things are big national stories, but we tend to talk about them here first.
C.J. Box, the author, visiting with us. His new book, the latest Joe Pickett novel, is Breaking Point, which just segue off of what you just said. You're obviously following up on something that got some national news. This is based on a Supreme Court case.
Right. It's the Sackett case, if anybody's familiar with that. That's a couple in Idaho up by Sandpoint that 6 years ago bought a 2-acre plot in a subdivision surrounded by houses. And once they started to move dirt, some EPA mid-level bureaucrats showed up and said that they were disturbing wetlands. And if they didn't cease immediately, they were going to be fined up to $80,000 a day until they did. And the Sacketts were amazed that this happened. They couldn't find their property on any list of databases. It still isn't on there. But they tried to fight it, but the EPA would not back down and took them finally all the way to the Supreme Court, where if the Sacketts would have lost, they would have owed the EPA $80 million. But they lost 9-0 in the Supreme Court. You know how many decisions come down 9-0. But the kind of disturbing fact about it is that they still haven't been able to build their house, because all that hearing did, all that decision did, was give them the right to a hearing. And when I heard about it, I don't like bullies of any kind, and I'd never heard a more outrageous story about overreach as that.
And Joe gets involved in this, and in fact, Joe this time ends up conflicted.
Yes, he's very conflicted because he is a government employee. He's a state government employee, and he's trying to enforce the law. And when two EPA agents show up murdered on that plot of land, he is recruited to help lead the search for the landowner who they assume did it.
And so many of your books have I could probably sit here and we could together rattle off a number of stories that are in Wyoming's news, from maybe the Amy Roe Bechtel case
to
others that you've more or less referred to in your stories. Mm-hmm. It must be kind of interesting and to get to tell those stories in a different way.
What it comes down to kind of is that sometimes when an issue is fictionalized so that readers can identify with the players on both sides of that issue, they can understand it better. And if it's told in a page-turning way, then it's compelling. When you put the book down, you hope that the reader says, boy, that kept me up all night, but I never thought about this certain thing this way before. And if that happens, then I think they're a success.
Do you get to the point, and maybe you're there already, that you're tired of Joe Pickett?
No, I'm not. I really enjoy writing the character. I'm working on the next book right now. And because he changes and his family changes and they age a year and circumstances change, it keeps it kind of fresh. At the end of this book, without giving anything away, he does have a real dilemma on what comes next. And that kind of thing keeps the series interesting to me.
The other thing I would just like you to address before we let you go is, you hang out with a lot of Wyoming writers, and there are people who have been very successful like yourself, and then there are others who are looking to turn the corner. What have you learned that you could share with other people?
Oh, wow. I guess one thing I've learned, kind of been surprised by actually, is that the New York publishers who publish these books have always encouraged me to kind of stay Western, stay local, mm-hmm. Be honest to the place and the character, and not try to write for them or another audience. And I think there's so many great stories and characters and issues in Wyoming and in the West that if portrayed honestly, they attract an audience.
The author is C.J. Box. The book is called Breaking Point. It's the latest Joe Pickett novel. It's out now. C.J., always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Ling Osofsky graduated from UW's Master of Fine Arts program in writing. She frequently wrote about feeling displaced, both culturally and geographically, when she came to Wyoming. In this essay, she writes about international students celebrating the Hindu festival of Holi on UW's campus. Holi celebrates the coming of spring and the colors that spring brings. This year, it will be celebrated on March 27th.
Prexy's Pasture. Prexy's Pasture is the central quad on the University of Wyoming's campus. Flanked by sandstone buildings, this green stretch is a grassy canvas for your needs. You can graze your horse here. You can play cricket here. It denies everyone equally. Most of the year, it is covered in snow and ice. But here you can celebrate the Hindu festival of Holi, celebrate the onset of spring and the end of the winter season. Anyone can join in. To participate, just throw colored paint and water. Celebrate the last full moon on the lunar calendar. Grab a fistful of brilliant powder and chuck it at whomever. The colors bleed in scattered patches, like a battlefield marked by cherry and orange, grape, and limeade casualties. Nina, my half-Indian, half-Irish friend, told me there are never enough colors to grab and splatter. Someone's mom ships the powder from India. In the end, though, everyone just ends up tossing handfuls of snow at each other. The South Asians in Wyoming are so far from home, they celebrate spring by throwing snow. And out here, there's simply not enough color to go around.
Thank you for listening to this edition of Open Spaces. If you missed the program or want to hear an individual segment, You may go to our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. That website will allow you to comment on stories and also sign up for our weekly podcast.
We also encourage listeners to send us ideas for future stories and become a fan of our Facebook page called Wyoming Public Radio News. Simply click on the like button. You can also find all of our reporters on Twitter. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.